in the area of dysfunction, when I talk about that, you're going to find that you don't always get help from outside sources unless you seek it professionally. Finding someone who will support you is a hard, time-consuming job, but once you find somebody who can give you assistance just to be a friend, it's much easier to take some of these activities and make them part of your life. So, as I sometimes do, I overkill things, but having things in front of you that you can read and look at while I talk is really important, because you'll connect with something there. You may latch onto one of these. You may find other things up there that's written that you say to yourself as you check them off, saying, yes, I do that for myself. I already do that. And some of the other things that are on the list you may want to look at as saying, I've never thought of that, and I would like to do something in that area. The second sheet is simply a bibliography of books that I have used as background material for the talks, the things that I did the last 2 days, and some of the things that I will do now. So, this is Mike Batham, third session, Fatal Memories of Dysfunction of Creativity and Reasonable Miracles, Breaking the Dysfunction. Incidentally, a number of these books are in the Holden Library, or have been in the Holden bookstore, and you can find them. Easy books to find. I'd like to start out by telling you a story. And part of the story is an emptiness. And that sounds a little strange, but I would like to tell you a story about a comedian who appears on a regular basis for a program that's on television, at least in the Seattle area, called The Improv Tonight, and I believe it comes out of the San Francisco area. The Improv Tonight zeroes in specifically on comedians, both men and women, and for the most part, most of the material they present is pretty raunchy. It's based on sexual connotations and dysfunctional families and attitudes that are anything but wholesome. But I was refreshed to see one time as I was switching dials, which I usually do, to find a comedian who had a very novel way of approaching his comic lines. He would tell a story, but at the end of each sentence, he would leave a word out. And he would leave a word out because he expected the audience to be as much involved in the process of the act as he was delivering. And he was a very casual person. He would just come up to the microphone, had his hands in his pockets, just kind of a laid-back guy, and he'd start telling the story. And at the end of each sentence, he'd leave the word out. Well, the audience began to pick this up and realize that they are supposed to fill in the added word. So he would tell a story. He'd say, I'd be walking down the street one, and somebody would yell a word out, and of course, everybody thought that was kind of cute, and everybody would kind of laugh. Well, as the story progressed, the comedian got in so much into the act of it himself. He didn't know what they were going to say. The audience didn't know what he was going to say. And they combined this whole silly story with insignificant words from out of nowhere. And by the halfway through the whole presentation, the comedian was laughing so hard at what they were saying, the audience was laughing so hard at what he was saying, that it was just a totally enriching experience. There was no dirty language, there was no sexual connotations, there was just this straight story about a guy walking down the street one day. And there was this special invitation between both sides that they could partake in the creativeness of this whole process. And at one point he had tears running down his face because he was laughing so hard, and the audience was slapping the table and thought that was so rich. And everybody had this expectancy that the next word that was going to come out was just going to be better than the last word. And it went on and went on and on, and the story never ended. And finally he just said, well, that's it. And the person filled in the last words, and that was Rory's too, and he just walked off the stage, and that was his act. He had a standing ovation for at least 5 minutes. because it was so original and so well thought out by both the audience and the comedian. And I can't help but think that in the ideal of life, God wants us to be participators as well as an audience, to be blessed and to be a blessing both from God and to God. So God invites us in to be a participator, to be part of the life structure. And I think that that is the ideal, to be part of that. Unfortunately, the reality of our lives is it doesn't always come out that way, that we fall short, that there are processes and there are family structures and there are life forces that cause us to be less than what we want to be. And I would like to read a poem that brings this to a head, that shows us the reality as opposed to the ideal. This is a poem called Flowers Are Red, about a little boy in school, and it's written by Harry Chapin. The little boy went the first day of school. He got some crayons and he started to draw. He put colors all over the paper, for colors was what he saw. And the teacher said, "What you doing, young man?" "I'm painting flowers," he said. She said, "It's not time for art, young man, and anyway, flowers are green and red. There's a time for everything, young man, and the way it should be done. You've got to show concern for everyone else, for you're not the only one." And she said, "Flowers are red, young man, and green leaves are green. There's no need to see flowers any other way than the way they've always been seen." But the little boy said, "There are so many colors in the rainbow, so many colors in the morning sun, so many colors in the flower, and I see every one." The teacher said, "You're sassy. There's ways that things should be done, and you're painting flowers the way they are, so repeat after me." And she said, "Flowers are red, young man, and green leaves are green. There's no need to see flowers any other way than the way they've always been seen." But the little boy said, "There are so many colors in the rainbow, so many colors in the morning sun, so many colors in the flower, and I see every one." The teacher put him in a corner. She said, "It's for your own good. You won't come out till you get it right and are responding like you should." Well, finally he got lonely. Frightened thoughts filled his head. He went up to the teacher, and this is what he said. And he said, "Flowers are red and green leaves are green. There's no need to see flowers any other way than the way they've always been seen." Time went by like it always does, and they moved to another town. The little boy went to another school, and this is what he found. The teacher there was smiling. She said, "Painting should be fun. There are so many colors in the flower, so let's use every one." But that little boy painted flowers in neat rows of green and red. When the teacher asked him why, this is what he said. And he said, "Flowers are red and green leaves are green. There's no need to see flowers any other way than the way they've always been seen." I think part of the problem that comes to mind, at least in my heart and in my mind, as the way that I have experienced things, is that in the growing up stages, and I have listed the areas of dysfunction from a beginning life cycle, is that the whole issue of dysfunction tends to circle itself around the idea that it's easy, or we can be easily swayed by the use of a belittling remark or a discounting statement. And they can be so subtle that we sometimes are not aware of them taking place. But they silently coerce us into changing our attitudes and changing our minds so that we become something other than what we were meant to be. And let me tell you a story about my own history. that's something that affects me even today, that happened in my own family. It's a well-known fact in my family that I do not spell things very well. In fact, you know, I look at my sheets there and then I have to check my lettering to see if I've done a pretty good job. And in most cases, I do. My older brother always reminded me that I could never spell very well. And that was his way of keeping control over me because he likes to be in control. And he felt that it was important to his own power structure to make sure that he kept control of me or took care of me, as he would has stated it in the past. And the subtle ways he would do those kinds of things was, I remember one time writing a paper for a master's thesis, and he read it through and he found a word that was misspelled. And he made a big thing out of that by saying, you know, you've misspelled a word here. And I said, well, I probably have. This is not the final draft yet. And he says, oh boy, you always had trouble with spelling. You never could spell. And finally, within the last year or so, I called him on the carpet for that, subtly, because he's always been shooting at me from the bush, coming to understand his own problems, and I could certainly shoot back at him for some things that he is not so good at, but I choose not to do that. But coming to the issue of saying, I don't like you belittling me in that way, I wish you would stop that. It was so much of a trauma for him, for me to take a stance of my own finally, that he has not talked to me in 6 months. I've written letters to him. I've tried to encourage him to come out and to talk with me about the whole thing, about the issues of dysfunction in our family, and he refuses. He's in total denial. And it's a scary thing because I love my brother. And I know somehow that he loves me, but there's this dysfunctional attitude, this problem that separates the both of us. So that is the kind of thing that can happen if we do not face the fact that that we would like to be living in the ideal, much like the audience reacting to the comedian and the comedian reacting to the audience, the sharing experience, the wholesomeness, the life-giving part of ourselves. The problem is that we do live in reality and we have problems, whether they're little insignificant ones that can be blown completely out of proportion, or whether they're great big ones that seethe underneath the surface. And some of the things that seethe happen in the issues of dysfunction that can lead to problems that are insurmountable in some cases. And I think that we're seeing great evidence in our country today of a lot of these particular problems that are going on, and I assume that a lot of them are going on, and this is somewhat of a theory, because we have started from dysfunctional families on the very small issue of belittling or making light of the fact that we are individual people and we have rights to live and to be creative and to be the kind of people that we are meant to be. So let me play out here my own little scenario of what can happen as we follow the issues of dysfunction from a family of origin situation through a school, into a business, perhaps into relationships, and finally into a church. This is following a little boy who is growing up in a family, and as the family functions, this is the kind of thing that can happen. There's a child at home at the dinner table, and he's having fun at the dinner table, and he's just relaxing, he's talking with his brothers and sisters. His father comes in and says, you know, you're too noisy at the dinner table. Will you be quiet, please? You're eating like a noisy pig. Reaction. Gee, Dad, I'm sorry. I guess I'm no good. Later, the child goes to school, and he is standing before the blackboard, and he's not doing too well in math, and takes him a little time to figure out how in the world to get this problem solved. So he's adding the columns up as fast as he can, and he's counting on his fingers, and he's running out of fingers, so he's doing it on the board with little dots. The teacher looks at him and thinks he's taking entirely too much time to get this problem done. And he says, "What's the matter? Can't you figure out this problem? You look like a chicken with your head cut off." The student freezes. The answer is not given, and he thinks, "Gee, teacher, I'm sorry. I guess I'm no good." Well, the boy grows up, goes on to college, graduates, gets a job. He's having trouble with the job because he's new to the business. He makes a presentation before his boss. The boss doesn't think much of the presentation and says, "You do sloppy work. You must be a sloppy person." Again, the burying aspect of the belittling takes place, and he says, "Gee, boss, I'm sorry. I must be no good." He then becomes married, and in a relationship with his wife, they're having an argument about having a party for the weekend and having friends over. The wife wants to have a large party, and he wants to have a small, intimate one. And finally, in the fury of the argument, she says, "You don't want to have a party this weekend at all. You don't like people." "Gee, partner, I'm sorry. I guess I'm no good." He attends church on Sunday, and the sermon is fire and brimstone. And later, under conviction, he goes up to receive the communion. But the message is, "I'm not worthy to receive you. Gee, God, I'm sorry. I must be no good." And in the transition of going from youth all through school, through business, through marriage, and into church, little remarks like that build up, and it's just like garbage being piled on top of us. And the weight of it begins to push us down, and we think that we'll never really be able to break the dysfunction and become our own selves, to stand up for ourselves and be able to say, "You know, I'm a good person. I do care. I do respect. I do love." But as these remarks begin to destroy us, one of three things, or I should say three things, begin to happen. First thing that happens is that our basic trust in ourselves begins to be broken. We no longer can trust ourselves to be able to do the kinds of things that we have always wanted to do. The second thing that happens is that we narrow our field of usefulness. And this is particularly important in the area of creativity. If there is something that is naturally a gift to us that we would like to use, we tend not to use it because people are telling us that we can't do what we are naturally gifted to do, or are told that we are no good through the remarks that they speak to us of. Third thing that happens is that it breaks our will to believe in any kind of unconditional love. And I think that when God first sent us to the earth, and I spoke about this earlier in one of the other sessions, the left and right brain orientation, was that when we were born, I think it was instilled within us that God wants us to have a balanced mind, to be useful out of both lobes of our mind, to be double dominant, not necessarily left-right brain at the extremes, but to make us one in that consideration. And I think also that we came into this world with all of the tools for unconditional love. But in the process of the breaking of our wills and the breaking of our beliefs, that the unconditional love is something now we have to come back into as we journey through life. So those three areas, the loss of trust in ourselves, the narrowing of our usefulness, and the breaking of unconditional love. So that we become frightened, we become fearful, we become anxious, and we get very angry at the fact that we cannot do the kinds of things that we want to do for ourselves. So in some respects, we do these kinds of things over here. We turn to alcohol, we get involved with drugs. We get involved with physical or verbal abuse, which is one tactic of fighting back for those who have put us down. We either eat too much or we don't eat enough, or we get involved with sexual excesses to make ourselves feel worthy. So we become very conditioned, and our conditioning becomes conditional love. There is always something there that makes us less than what we would like to be. Now I have another role play, but it takes a couple of other people, so I will just talk about it rather than try and work it through. Whenever I'm doing some artwork, it surprises me that when people come by to look to see what I'm doing, they always are amazed at how well I can do things. And listening long enough, they start opening themselves up without my having to respond much. Maybe it's just the fact that my doing the artwork gives them license to feel free to see and observe. And then they begin to reflect on their own lives. They tell stories like, you know, I can't do that. And I'd say, well, why can't you do that? And say, well, I just can't do that. I'm not very artistic. And so I let it go, and then I keep drawing a bit more. And they continue their own conversations as if they're simply talking to themselves or talking out their life structure. They say, you know, I wish I could do that. That would really be fun. I've always admired people who could do artwork. And then it goes on a little bit longer. And then they say, oh, you're left-handed. I was told you could never be left-handed and be an artist. And then it goes on a little bit further. You know, I couldn't draw a straight line with a ruler. And that's about the time I enter the conversation with something valid. And I'd say, of course you can. But then they come back with their own discounting remark saying, no, I can't. I can't draw a straight line with a ruler. And that then that begins the whole process of the discussion between myself and the person who's talking to me. And they'll get to the point, almost to the point of being convinced that they can draw a straight line with a ruler, and then they fall back on themselves and say, no, I can't do that. My parents told me I could never be artistic, and I guess they're right. So people can reach a stage where they've been discounted and belittled so long that they become their own belittling system, that they discount themselves. And they talk to themselves out of things that they think they could do, but don't. So that's one aspect of the deepness and the pain that brings us to all of the problems that ensue. So we work from family of origin. We grew up in a family. Most of us, in some degree or another, suffered some kind of pain. We go to school. We get involved in business. We get into a marriage or into a church where things did not work out as progressively as we thought they would. And so the first reaction would be something of a deep anger, not the kind of anger that we would recognize. It's something that gets pushed down inside of us. There's an angry spot. But the anger is something that we can really work with. In fact, most of these emotions we can really deal with. And part of the activities that I had given yesterday particularly, where we worked on some artwork, some of these issues actually came out. Because as we become artistic, we then become part of that creative process, much like the audience involved with the comedian. We tend to forget the fact that we are caught in some of these traps, and that we can take part in the creative process. So in the process of working on something creative, we become people of power. We assume our own power. We can take charge of ourselves. Nobody's there to tell us we can't do something because we are actually involved in it. So keeping at it long enough, we can work through these stages. We can identify our own anger. We can work with our own anxiety. We can deal with the issues of our own fears and what gets us into a fear. Working in the areas of depression, yesterday I gave a talk on moods as the way of the unconscious, identifying our own creativity, so that we can actually come together and work in the areas of moods and depressions, that it is actually our system telling us in one way or another, you know, there's something wrong. There's something wrong that you're not able to do the things you want to. Look at yourself and find out what those things are and break the dysfunction. Sometimes even psychosomatic illnesses take over, because if we're not willing to deal with our depressions, our fears, anxieties, and our angers, then that all turns inwardly in on us and begins to eat us, begins to chew away at our flesh and our mind, and we become physically sick because of it. So these are some of the extremes that happen because we are not willing to deal with issues that come about. So our own friends, our own family, the places where we work, the businesses we are involved with and so forth, even our own relationships sometimes contribute to the dysfunction of our own lives. Well, that's the fatal memory section, the dysfunction that breaks. How do we get out of that? What do we do for ourselves? This is a part where there would be a normal break and I would go put a bunch of clothes on. I mean, I'd put everything on. I'd have coats and sweaters and I'd have gloves and I'd have a variety of hats. And I would come in looking like the Pillsbury Doughboy. And then I would begin talking about how we can begin breaking dysfunction. But because it's so warm in here already and I didn't have enough clothes, I'd just soon not have to sweat up here. But I would begin to role play and I would come out in the heavy clothes and I'd begin to take them off, and we would talk about some of those psychological issues that would help us to break the dysfunction. So on the second side of the scale here, so how do I make a change? How do I break issues of dysfunction? How do I come into myself? And this is the part where we really need to look at the area of courage. And I had another book yesterday called The Courage to Create by Rollo May. And he talks about how much courage it takes, first of all, just to be creative and compassionate to yourself. If other people can't be compassionate, you need to be compassionate to yourself and tell yourself it's okay, I am who I am, and that I need to be someone of my own and work on the area of creativity. Now, I want to surround all this by saying sometimes this takes a lot of outside help. A pastor, spiritual director, psychotherapist, a really good listening friend, someone who will support you in listening to your story as you begin to work through this. And I would encourage those of you who have maybe identified with some of this information to take those kinds of to take that kind of courage and be a risk taker. Because an artist, a creative person, whatever, if you're working with your hands or you're working with your mind or you're doing some business, whatever that creativity is, it really demands that you take courage and that you be a risk taker. Of course, that's a lot of what life is all about anyway. Some astute person had said sometime that how risky it is just to get up each morning and live the day. Another really good book, and this is one that helps break the dysfunction, I found it very useful, called Your Inner Child of the Past. Because what we're dealing with here is part of us, is that there are three parts to us. And they all work hand in hand. There is the child, there is the parent, and then there is the adult. And they all have components. Sort of like Mickey Mouse here. Now, why not have some fun? Anyway, the child is the first, the adult is the second, and the parent is the third. Now, they can all interact with one another, but for a lot of the dysfunction in our lives, when it starts at a young age, the child is hurt, and we need to help the child become more lifelike, to be playful and to bring it into new life. And the parent and the adult can be either punitive or life-giving. And if these are all in harmony, then we begin to grow and to change ourselves and to grow out of dysfunction into new life. Okay, I would like to read a little bit from You're in Your Child of the Past by Hugh Misseldine. Is a medical doctor in the Southern California area who's specialized in dealing with children and their dysfunctions. All of your feelings must receive serious consideration. Hiding, denying, or belittling any feeling you have in an act of disrespect toward yourself, and it automatically divides you, creating conflict, renewing conflict, I should say, between your child of the past and you as a parent to yourself. Therefore, the way to accept your child of the past is to give all your feelings serious, respectful consideration. If your desires do not interfere with your adult goals or the rights of others, you should try to fulfill those desires. However, if the feelings from your childhood are permitted free expression, they may interfere with your adult life or the rights of others. To use a broad, perhaps ridiculous example, if your child of the past doesn't want to get up in the morning and go to work, and you indulge this feeling, you are letting these childhood feelings interfere with your adult life. You may lose your job and be unable to do the things that you, the adult, really want to do. In a similar fashion, you may have trouble limiting your anger because your temper tantrums were indulged by your parents. You may eat too much or want what you want when you want it, regardless of others, because someone indulged your whims in childhood. Therefore, you must set firm limits in allowing these feelings to be expressed. Controlling these feelings often hurt. All children howl at times when needed restrictions are imposed, and your child of the past is no exception. In imposing limits, you must not criticize or belittle these feelings, yet you must not allow them to be expressed in a way that interferes with your adult living. The pain you experience when you impose limits is not damaging, and it will become less intense as you continue to set them. There's a whole book. The whole book is all lined with stars and little asterisks and all kinds of things, because it has so much information in it of things that were caused during the childhood that causes the adult and or the parent to act out in strange behavior. The adult saying, I can't draw a straight line with the ruler. The parent overruling that adult and saying, that's true, from the experiences of the frightened child. So the concert here is to get these three into balance so that they're all in harmony with one another. But it requires a lot of work just to soothe the inner child and not allow the belittling that happened from the parents from outside the child to control that action. And once the work begins on the child, then the parent and the adult can then think back, well, what was it that went on in my background that caused these kinds of feelings that I couldn't do something? And then that requires looking at their particular parents and their particular background, or why did they act the way they did? So it becomes not only cultural, but it becomes historic at the same time.